File 22. Generally speaking, we must not forget that the highest aim of human existence is not the maintenance of a state of government, but rather the conservation of the race. If the race is in danger of being oppressed or even exterminated, the question of legality is only of secondary importance. The established power may, in such a case, employ only those means which are recognized as legal, yet the instinct of self-preservation on the part of the oppressed will always justify to the highest degree the employment of all possible resources. Only on the recognition of this principle was it possible for those struggles to be carried through, of which history furnishes magnificent examples in abundance, against foreign bondage or oppression at home. Human rights are above the rights of the state. But if a people be defeated in the struggle for its human rights, this means that its weight has proved too light in the scale of destiny to have the luck of being able to endure in this terrestrial world. The world is not there to be possessed by the faint-hearted races. Austria affords a very clear and striking example of how easy it is for tyranny to hide its head under the cloak of what is called legality. The legal exercise of power in the Habsburg state was then based on the anti-German attitude of the Parliament with its non-German majorities, and on the dynastic house, which was also hostile to the German element. The whole authority of the state was incorporated in these two factors. To attempt to alter the lot of the German element through these two factors would have been senseless. Those who advised the legal way as the only possible way, and also obedience to the state authority, could offer no resistance, because a policy of resistance could not have been put into effect through legal measures. To follow the advice of the legalist councillors would have meant the inevitable ruin of the German element within the monarchy, and this disaster would not have taken long to come. The German element has actually been saved only because the state as such collapsed. The spectacle theorist would have given his life for his doctrine rather than for his people. Because man has made laws, he subsequently comes to think that he exists for the sake of the laws. A great service rendered by the pan-German movement was that it abolished all such nonsense, though the doctrinaire theorists and other fetish worshippers were shocked. When the Habsburgs attempted to come to close quarters with the German element by the employment of all the means of attack which they had at their command, the pan-German party hit out ruthlessly against the illustrious dynasty. This party was the first to probe into and expose the corrupt condition of the state, and in doing so, they opened the eyes of hundreds of thousands. To have liberated the high ideal of love for one's country from the embrace of this deplorable dynasty was one of the great services rendered by the pan-Germanic movement. When that party first made its appearance, it secured a large following. Indeed, the movement threatened to become almost an avalanche. But the first successes were not maintained. At the time I came to Vienna, the pan-German party had been eclipsed by the Christian Socialist Party, which had come into power in the meantime. Indeed, the pan-German party had sunk to a level of almost complete insignificance. The rise and decline of the pan-German movement on the one hand, and the marvellous progress of the Christian Socialist Party on the other, became a classic object of study for me, and as such, they played an important part in the development of my own views. When I came to Vienna, all my sympathies were exclusively with the pan-German movement. I was just as much impressed by the fact that they had the courage to shout Heil Hohenzollern as I rejoiced at their determination to consider themselves an integral part of the German Empire, from which they were separated only provisionally. They never missed an opportunity to explain their attitude in public, which raised my enthusiasm and confidence. To avow one's principles publicly on every problem that concerned Germanism, and never to make any compromises, seemed to me the only way of saving our people. What I could not understand was how this movement broke down so soon after such a magnificent start. And it was no less incomprehensible that the Christian Socialists should gain such tremendous power within such a short time. They had just reached the pinnacle of their popularity. When I began to compare those two movements, fate placed before me the best means of understanding the causes of this puzzling problem. The action of fate, in this case, was hastened by my own straitened circumstances. I shall begin my analysis with an account of the two men who must be regarded as the founders and leaders of the two movements. These were George von Schönerer and Dr. Karl Lueger. As far as personality goes, both were far above the level and stature of the so-called parliamentary figures. They lived lives of immaculate and irreproachable probity, amidst the miasma of all-round political corruption. Personally, I first liked the pan-German representative, Schönerer, and it was only afterwards and gradually that I felt an equal liking for the Christian Socialist leader. When I compared their respective abilities, Schönerer seemed to me a better and more profound thinker on fundamental problems. He foresaw the inevitable downfall of the Austrian state more clearly and accurately than anyone else. If this warning in regard to the Habsburg Empire had been heeded in Germany, the disastrous world war which involved Germany against the whole of Europe would never have taken place. But though Schönerer succeeded in penetrating to the essentials of a problem, he was very often much mistaken in his judgment of men. And herein lay Dr. Lueger's special talent. He had a rare gift of insight into human nature, and he was very careful not to take men as something better than they were in reality. He based his plans on the practical possibilities which human life offered him, whereas Schönerer had only little discrimination in that respect. All ideas that this pan-German had were right in the abstract, but he did not have the forcefulness or understanding necessary to put his ideas across to the broad masses. He was not able to formulate them so that they could be easily grasped by the masses, whose powers of comprehension are limited, and will always remain so. Therefore, all Schönerer's knowledge was only the wisdom of a prophet, and he never could succeed in having it put into practice. This lack of insight into human nature led him to form a wrong estimate of the forces behind certain movements and the inherent strengths of old institutions. Schönerer indeed realized that the problems he had to deal with were in the nature of a Weltanschauung, but he did not understand that only the broad masses of a nation can make such convictions prevail, which are almost of a religious nature. Unfortunately, he understood only very imperfectly how feeble is the fighting spirit of the so-called bourgeoisie. That weakness is due to their business interests, which individuals are too much afraid of risking, and which therefore deter them from taking action. And, generally speaking, a Weltanschauung can have no prospect of success unless the broad masses declare themselves ready to act as its standard-bearers and to fight on its behalf wherever and to whatever extent that may be necessary. This failure to understand the importance of the lower strata of the population resulted in a very inadequate concept of the social problem. In all this, Dr. Luger was the opposite of Schoenerer. His profound knowledge of human nature enabled him to form a correct estimate of the various social forces, and it saved him from underrating the power of existing institutions. And it was perhaps this very quality which enabled him to utilize those institutions as a means to serve the purposes of his policy. He saw only too clearly that, in our epoch, the political fighting power of the upper classes is quite insignificant, and not at all capable of fighting for a great new movement until the triumph of that movement be secured. Thus, he devoted the greatest part of his political activity to the task of winning over those sections of the population whose existence was in danger, and fostering the militant spirit in them rather than attempting to paralyze it. He was also quick to adopt all available means for winning the support of long-established institutions, so as to be able to derive the greatest possible advantage for his movement from those old sources of power. Thus it was, first of all, he chose as the social basis of his new party that middle class which was threatened with extinction. In this way, he secured a solid following which was willing to make great sacrifices and had good fighting stamina. His extremely wise attitude towards the Catholic Church rapidly won over the younger clergy in such large numbers that the old clerical party was forced to retire from the field of action, or else, which was the wiser course, to join the new party in the hope of gradually winning back one position after another. But it would be a serious injustice to the man if we were to regard this as his essential characteristic, for he possessed the qualities of an able tactician and had the true genius of a great reformer, but all these were limited by his exact perception of the possibilities at hand, and also of his own capabilities. The aims which this really eminent man decided to pursue were intensely practical. He wished to conquer Vienna, the heart of the monarchy. It was from Vienna that the last pulses of life beat through the diseased and worn-out body of the decrepit empire. If the heart could be made healthier, the other parts of the body were bound to revive. That idea was correct in principle, but the time within which it could be applied in practice was strictly limited, and that was the man's weak point. His achievements as burgomaster of the city of Vienna are immortal, in the best sense of the word. But all that could not save the monarchy. It came too late. His rival, Schoenera saw this more clearly. What Dr. Luger undertook to put into practice turned out marvelously successful, but the results which he expected to follow his achievements did not come. Schoenera did not attain the ends he had proposed to himself, but his fears were realized, alas, in a terrible fashion. Thus, both these men failed to attain their further objective. Luger could not save Austria, and Schoenera could not prevent the downfall of the German people in Austria.